Hello, I'm Ray Strecker. I'm your moderator for today's insight. You can find my bio in the top of your About page on Clued. The way this works is that you follow online and on the call. Online, you will open the presentation file at the bottom of your About page where you see Files. Follow the discussion through the PowerPoint. We like this to be participatory, so please, ask questions as you go in the comments section below the presentation or in the conversation tab. The whole group can communicate that way, and we'll answer questions you submit online either now or later.
Given our topic, I'm going to venture to guess that everyone listening today has a role in sales and in deciding the sales model for their firm, and that those things are very important to our success. We want this to be interactive, so we'd like people to ask questions throughout and talk in the site. So let me turn things over to Peter.
Hey, thanks, Ray. And thanks, everybody, for joining us for today's insight, which is a disarmingly simple framework for thinking about sales in a services business. And it's turned out to be a framework that's been quite helpful to many organizations. And while you may already be familiar with it, we thought you might like to have it in a form to share with others or that you can use as a script for working with people that you work with in your organization. So that's really the intent of this. Let's start by looking at page 3, at what conventionally happens ahead of an opportunity to provide services to a customer. If you look in the upper right, you see an S-curve-shaped line that runs up and to the right, and that represents the project or the cumulative payments for services delivered over time. And ahead of that, to the left, are ovals leading up to the starting point, when each oval represents a discrete set of work or work steps taken to make that opportunity to deliver services a reality. On the far left is business development, which is where you frame and lay the groundwork for what services will be sold to whom. And then next to that to the right is prospecting, where you identify a particular buyer who might purchase the service you have in mind. Then above that we have capture, where you pull together a work plan, pricing, win themes, and terms, and you drive to present all that, ultimately to a potential prospective buyer in the form of a proposal, which you then package, communicate, and cultivate to a close. And boom, you have the idea to provide a specific set of services to a specific buyer with a specific set of terms. And if everything goes well, the proposal is accepted, and on page 4, voila, we have a sale leading to a project in which what was promised is delivered on time and on budget. And that's the conventional model for selling and doing in a services business.
So, Peter, when I think about small companies that I've worked with or seen over the years, I find that a lot of times they get started essentially because an opportunity falls into someone's lap. And selling can, at the beginning, feel so easy that there's not much reason to think about it. But then at some point, the leader looks up and doesn't see the next sale falling out of the sky. So what then?
Well, that's exactly right. If you look on page 5, we summarize what can happen. But a good example of that happened during the internet craze in the 90s, when there was so much demand for internet-based systems that services firms sprung up literally overnight and grew to tens, even in some cases hundreds of millions in annual revenue, without ever having to learn how to sell. But eventually they hit the wall you described and start asking questions like these. For example, how do I sell the next job when I'm swamped delivering the one I'm on? And how can I bring somebody else into the picture to do what I do when they don't, to sell what I do when they don't even do it themselves? They're just a specialist in selling. So these kind of questions befuddle the leaders. Shouldn't we hire somebody who knows everything about the industry and everyone in it to represent us in the market? Should our engagement leaders do the selling? How do we come up with the next thing to sell? And all of that becomes overwhelming. And what tends to happen at that point is two classes of solutions emerge first to solve what I call the demand creation problem. Both of the solutions are good and have merit, but they also both present challenges. We'll look at those on page 6. Where on the left-hand side, you see on the chart on page 6, the strategy to hire a professional salesperson whose only job is to sell against a commission plan. And salespeople are sometimes referred to as coin-operated, because if you get the incentives right, you drive the behavior that leads to the results you seek. But it's hard to get the commission plan right, and if it's not right, a lot of time and money can lead to very little results. Most salespeople come into the picture with a Rolodex of past connections, some of which they can turn into sales. And then when they run through all their names, it turns out that only a few of those are really good at making productive new contacts, which is why the average tenure for good salespeople is usually about a couple of years. On the right, you see another model, and that's to hire someone who both sells and who delivers. And this is common in the partner model you see in law firms, accounting firms, consulting firms that grew out of accounting firms. The super strong partner has a relatively few highly productive relationships that drive a lot of work that kind of goes on, more or less without end. And while this approach can lead to a large practice, it tends to grow slowly because it's hard to find and develop people who are good at both selling and doing. And there's little sharing across partners, so the collection of partners has little value beyond their personal details. The organization itself doesn't have its own value. So in the end, both approaches are valuable, but we've found that success takes more than great salespeople and great sellers and doers, and that an organization that relies just on strong players without a model underlying a system of selling will disappoint in terms of growth.
So I think in a lot of ways you've started us on a very sort of a great sounding and correct journey to putting together a sales team and an approach. But it also feels like something that's going to take time. So if we're our hypothetical firm sort of coming to this realization, but also looking at a cliff, what are the things to do that might help, you know, next quarter or next year, as well as the things that'll help over the next 20 years?
Well, from my experience, having grown into and worked with literally dozens of services firms, I can tell you that almost always it's the case that there's more work to be had where you already are working than you have anywhere near cultivated. In fact, we have people ahead of this call to fill out a survey, and 3/4 of the people that filled it out said that they had felt that less than 50% of all possible revenue from existing clients had been captured. So you see, even in the population here, that sentiment runs true. And the reality is that time and effort spent cultivating opportunities to deliver more value through extending and expanding the current work often are under-realized. There's a couple of steps you need to go through to get that opportunity to become a reality. Number one is to make sure that not only that you're doing good work on time, on target. I mean, people doing the work tend to focus mostly on doing it on time, on target, on budget, and that's a wonderful thing to do. It's absolutely critical to doing anything else, but that's not all you need to be doing. The next thing you need to be doing is making sure the customer, the beneficiary of what you're doing, appreciates the value of the work that you've performed. And by the way, part of having that happen means the people doing the delivery need to think that what they're doing is valuable and worth not just what their customers are paying for it, but maybe even more. So that if you have people doing work that believe that what they're doing is worth 3 times what it's getting paid for, will ultimately carry around with them the thought, the messaging, the way of being that is picked up by the customer, and the customer will feel the same way. And then the opportunity is to find and develop ways to deliver even more value while you're there, making the engagement generally larger or longer. So if you have a service engagement, you maybe rather than just running a course over some number of months, you end up with twice as many months. And rather than just doing the work in one functional area, you're doing it to 2 functional areas. The idea of extending, expanding becomes a conscious effort to deliver more value.
You know, that's a tremendous point. And something I've always observed is that when you look at business planning exercises, for some reason, and I've probably done it myself, probably we all have, people always want to be conservative about their projection for their existing work.
And then they have a tendency then to say, but if I'm going to grow, I need these gigantic amounts of work from all these new places I don't know anything about. And I think it, when as a general manager, it's important to really sort of add a counterweight or a correction to that process and say, look, you know, for next quarter, it's got to be where we are.
Right. There's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm for the new logo as opposed to getting all there is where you are. But what we say, do great work where you are, get all there is where you are, and then get one more. And that's the mindset we want people to have.
So if we do the right things, there should be some clients we can work at and maybe even grow with forever.
Yeah, I mean, in addition to extending and expanding in right in the very part of the organization or customer that you're currently working, generally, if you pop your head up and spend time in the lunchroom and walk the halls, you'll see other people doing other things that you could also help with. So we have on slide 8 the notion that you use the current project as a platform upon which to stand and explore other parts of the organization to try to get something going, just like what you have here elsewhere. So if you're in the collections department of a bank, now you go to the servicing department and the fraud department and the lost and stolen department and the servicing department. And there's all kinds of places to do similar work to what you're doing, but in other places in the same organization. They call this account development or find new opportunities to deliver value nearby to where you already are delivering.
And then as we're doing that, we should also be looking for new clients, right? Yeah. And how do we convince new clients to give us the chance? Because there's maybe somebody already there who's doing what we're doing for this organization that we're expanding in, and we don't necessarily know anybody.
Right. Well, when I was developing my first services practice, it grew ultimately to a couple $100 million. I remember coming up with the slogan that I do what I do and Accenture does everything else. The idea is to be very clear about what you do that delivers extraordinary value to those who need it and put it into a form that others can see, relate to, and want. So on page 9, I'm suggesting this by saying that what you do is you take what you've done, you take what you've come up with, you take what you've learned, generally in the form usually of data, methods, software, or any other form of intellectual property like a tool or an asset that you can come up with, that gives you an unfair advantage such that the next prospect, someone who you know needs what you have, but he's already perhaps involved with others or thinking about others, but they can look at you as being uniquely able to meet their specific and important needs because of what you've done and how you've put together what you have and what you've learned and what you know from prior experience. And that gives you an unfair advantage. And that's what you want to have in growing a services business, an unfair advantage to solve an important, pervasive, and persistent problem. Now, if you look on page 10, you can see how that changes the whole picture leading up to a sale. So the black circles are from before. The green is from the solutions approach. And in this approach, there's a new work step. It's depicted by the green circles. And what you do with those steps is you consolidate what you've learned and package and disseminate it to three audiences, prospective buyers, current clients, and your team. And what happens when you do that is you sort of change the whole game. The solution offering approach changes the business in three specific and powerful ways. One, it lowers the cost of selling because you have now a way of pointing to something and saying, that's what we're going to give you. It's not an abstraction, it's there. And it lowers the cost of delivery because you've done it before, you've learned some things, you know what works and what doesn't, and you can just be a much straighter line to go from here to there. And it lowers the cost of growing capacity to sell and deliver because now you know what people need to know to be functional and helpful, and you can find people who can do that and train them up. They don't have to already know it. You can train them, and it gives you the opportunity to grow faster. Now on page 11, you see those points plus a few others about solution offering led sales and also some cautions. The problem that you address with your solution has to be important. That is, it needs to be solved for a suitably large number of organizations such that you have an interesting market. And now that needs to be at a price point that gives a profit after you've added in the costs of these new things, packaging, developing, and supporting the offering. And some of these costs have to be incurred up front. So the little bit of packaging, to get that first offering, a little bit of development, to turn it into something that you can take from where you are to the next place, and putting in position some people and resources to help those who are selling and doing and benefiting from the offering. A little bit of all of that has to be done up front. And then once you're successful doing this and you're in the business now of selling and delivering a specific offering, I know this may be hard to imagine if you're not already in the business, but what can happen is, and this happened in the business I was referring to earlier, we had to consciously figure this out and come around it, was that you get into the mindset of our business now is to sell and deliver and get out and go to the next one. So the idea is to stay out of the in-do-out mode and remember that it's all about the offering getting you in so that you can go in further, extend, expand, find new nearby. So it's in, as opposed to in-do-out.
So you've given us a lot of things to think about here. And I guess what occurs to me is, you know, should a small company do one of these things or all of these things? And how do you find the people that can do all of these great but different sounding kinds of things?
Yeah, it can be overwhelming to all of a sudden get all of this. Oh, my goodness, there's all a bunch of stuff we haven't been doing that we now know we need to be doing. It's all summarized in one place in the picture on page 12, which is sort of your infographic, if you will. And each of the blue circles represents a whole body of work. And the question is, who gets to do which of these? And if you look on page 13, we've identified the key and common roles and what to watch when you're performing each to know how well you're doing. And we don't need to go through each of these in detail, but you can look at it later. But the key thing is that each role, you know, selling, delivering, doing, extending, expanding, managing offerings, each of those requires different skills, different ways of thinking and being, or orientations, and different focus. Like, what am I spending my time thinking about and doing? Each of those roles tends to draw on different skills, orientations, and focus in order to be performed well. So, for example, a new account salesperson may be used to manage projects, but very few project managers make good new account salespeople. But the best ones, perhaps, were project managers. So many, though not all, project managers might be good and should be good at extending and expanding current engagements. So it's kind of a navigation here to figure out how we're going to staff these. There's a couple problems that generally happen. If you look on page 14, summarize the implications of all this. The most common mistakes are two. One, this may be where you're starting now, is you don't make clear any of this. No one's clear who has responsibility for what. No one explicitly has responsibility for extending, expanding, finding new nearby, or packaging what you've done. None of that is assigned. None of it gets done. The second thing that goes wrong is once you realize it, you say, okay, yeah, we need to do all that. Let's let the project team do it. Then we have the project manager and the project team, which is, by the way, very busy delivering on time, on target, and on budget, all of a sudden now responsible for all of the above, and that's not going to work either. So the trick is, the right way to do it, summarized on page 15, and this does work, is to match what is to be done with the abilities and interests of those you have to work with, realizing that, of course, you can add to your skill mix by hiring people who you bring into the picture that have the skills you need that you don't already have. Don't try to teach rabbits to swim. You know, let's figure out who's good at what, and let's make those matches. And then communicate it clearly and to each of the people what it is you want them to do. Who is going to do what? Have them come up with a plan to do it, and then monitor and reward them when they do. And then along the way, conduct regular management reviews to look at the plans that they have and to monitor progress against them. Provide guidance and direction every step of the way.
So we're going to talk for a few minutes about, you know, next steps and that a company can take to apply these ideas. And I understand that one of our participants, Katie, is an account manager who's recently conducted an account review with Intellivent. Katie, maybe you could speak up now and give us a little briefing on your experiences here.
Hi, everyone. My name is Katie Camargo. We're a management consulting firm. As Ray mentioned, I did participate in one of these account reviews within the past 2 months. I'll give a little bit of context about that. I run the account of one of our largest and longest standing clients, and they're a very strategic client for our business. And obviously, we have a very strong interest in extending and growing our work with them, not only through the next year, but indefinitely. And we've had great success working with them over the past, I'd say, 3 years. So the current contract that we're working on is actually ending in January. And, you know, we have a lot of relationships on the ground, myself, my CEO, and we were told that the client was going to actually compete the next phase of work. And so, of course, given the strategic nature of this client, we decided to schedule an account review with Peter and Steve to make sure that we were preparing in the right way for this RFP that we knew was going to drop. I'm guessing that my CEO had a gut feeling that maybe we weren't preparing in the right way, which is why we really benefited from taking a step back and working with Peter and Steve. So in terms of what I did, I knew that preparation was really important for this meeting. So I prepared. I focused on setting the context around what was going on in the account, just outlining the relationships that we have and some of the political dynamics at play. I really did this more just to give Peter and Steve context around what was going on the ground, the leadership changes that were imminent that we knew were coming. But I really viewed this as necessary context to provide to them so that they could advise us on the specifics of the RFP that we believed was dropping. So I tried to lay out, you know, who we believed the competition was and what our actual project plan would be to write a response. So that's a little bit about how I prepared in terms of what actually happened. We conducted the call, and what I can say is that Peter specifically completely reframed the problem for me. He gave me a number of insights, which I can talk about just by saying this. First of all, it's human nature, particularly when you build relationships with clients, to want to do what they ask you to do. Peter, in previous conversations, we've talked about the idea that in any relationship, you're either acting in a parent, peer, or child role to your client, and it changes based on the context. And while in delivery, I'm used to acting in a peer parent role as I coach them through what we're currently working on, I didn't realize that when it came to this RFP, I was actually playing more of a child role in this particular scenario, because I was just responding to what they were asking me to do. I wasn't taking a step back and looking at the bigger picture of what they needed me to do. So we had the conversation. What I did after that was essentially, without getting into the details of it, look at the bigger picture for what was best for them, and then proceeded on kind of a 2-month plan to push them to what I knew was right for them. And I will say that envisioning that bigger picture is challenging sometimes, particularly when you're in an ambiguous world of culture change, which is the world that we live in. So that's been a process, but having the discipline to think about it in that way was really critical. And so the ultimate benefit to us and to the company, and Peter actually doesn't even know this, is that we had strategic conversations with the individuals that we felt like we needed to work with to get them to see the bigger picture and do what was needed and the right thing for the client. We had those conversations, and we actually got word last night that they are essentially going with what we recommended. They're not going to compete this RFP. They're just going to continue to use the services that we're providing. And this is obviously a huge benefit to us, but it's also a huge benefit to them, because they're approaching it in the right way. And that really is the most important thing. So that was my experience. Happy to answer questions about that, but I'll turn it back over to you, Peter and Ray.
That's a great story.
That's heart-stopping. Thank you, Katie. Yeah, I mean, the value, as you may have gathered, I mean, the value in the account review is incredible. Knowing, you know, stepping back and looking at the whole of what you're doing, what are you trying to do? What have you done to do it? What happened when you did it? What did you learn from that? What do you plan to do next? That discipline of constantly going through that, even just preparing to do that, gives you a lift. Even if you don't even have the review, just getting ready to do that is an incredible lift. And we we encourage, as you see on page 15, that you do that step, the review step, call it an executive session or an account review or a sales review or a project review or a customer review or a unit review. That's sort of the governing process that sits on top of all of this. If you think about it, it's like a board for a company does this for the whole of the company. What we're talking about is taking that discipline, that governance, down a level and to do the same sort of governance on selling opportunities, on project work to make sure that what we're doing on time, on target, on the budget, but also extending and expanding and doing on custom reviews like Katie just described to be sure that the whole of the account is being considered right and best overall to deliver the full potential of value to your client. Then solutions, same thing. What do we got here? Does it really solve an important, pervasive, and persistent problem with economics that we can support and drive a profit over? And basically, it's a venture capital play, looking at it like the seed for a new business in that disciplined way from a governance point of view is extraordinarily valuable. And then if you have a collection of clients, a collection of offerings, a collection of prospects, you put all that together, you might call that a unit, like a business unit. So you have a specific market problem solution combination gives you essentially a business. And then for each of these, sales, projects, customer solutions, and units, what's the plan? Who's got the plan? Who's in charge of making it happen and coming up with it and doing it? What's been done against the plan? What happened when you did it? What did you learn from that? What do you plan to do next? And then what has to go right going forward? Putting all that together to review with a outside forum that includes people like us or people from your industry or who are otherwise connected to the organization adds extraordinary value. So we encourage everybody to do that.
Yeah, I just had a comment, and maybe Katie can chip in too. It seems like in my experience, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, I'm just saying it's my experience as an external person, we go in and do one thing, let's say executive assessment, and we get tagged for doing that one thing at the exclusion right. of a broad range of other topics that we could do. It's like, hey, I can do strategic coaching design, I can do training and development, I can do team right. facilitation. So the question then is, I suppose, maybe I'm answering my own question, is how do you build a deep enough partner relationship so that you can educate them and gain credibility to do more? Because we do have to overcome that exclusion kind of tagged, mindset.
Right.
So maybe you have a comment.
Yeah, I do. In fact, Ray and I have talked about this over the years a lot. I mean, it's like the blind men and the elephant. You have six blind men and each approach an elephant, touch a different part of the elephant, and each one thinks it's a different thing because of what they've experienced. Your job and what we've learned over time is well, first of all, if you're a small organization, the risk is that you'll try to be too many things. And if you're a big organization, you'll forget to introduce the rest of what you do. Those are the two. Ray, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. I think, going directly to Brent's question, you need to look for forums, particularly with the decision maker, people that you work with as opposed to more than maybe the day-to-day people, to make sure that you do tell them about the firm more broadly. If your firm does things like, publish a blog or other things, you can, minimum kinds of things, or make sure that you've, you've gotten them linked onto the blog, or you're sending them your articles via email, or, various things like that. But essentially, you have to realize that it's part of your job, I think, to educate the client. And if you're in that mode where you have, say, a few great seller doer partners and this account is, Joe, you've got to make sure that, somehow or other you create an opportunity for Steve to come around and talk to somebody about what he does,
Right. You mean, the risk is of not doing that is you get to the in, do out model, right? I get in, do my assessment, get out. And that's,
right.
That's not optimum. So it needs to be a conscious part of the delivery plan to educate the client along the way. It's the whole of what you do to make sure you get all the risk where you are.
Yeah.
Somebody else want to ask a question or a comment?
Peter, this is Katie. I could comment on that just from my experience. And I think tie it back to the story that I was just telling. I think, and it really is probably just restating what you just said in a different way, but this idea of painting the bigger picture is the words I've found to be effective in that, and based on the guidance that you gave me. And I don't know how long typical engagements are for individuals on the phone, but for us, they tend to be shorter. Right now, we're really in kind of the 3 to 6 month range of most of the engagements that we are working with clients on. So what really helps is to show that 1 year, 2 year view and show all of the pieces that they could do, and then back up into that what it is that we can do for them immediately, but also make it clear that we're not trying to sell them on some of the other things down the road, but that we do that. And when they come around to that conclusion that they need it, that we will be the logical place for them to go. So hopefully that's
very well put. So you paint as a matter of course, you paint a very big picture and show what it is you're doing now in the context of that larger picture. And that becomes an easy conversation at various points along the way to say, okay, now where are we in the big picture, as opposed to picture being this one little thing that you're doing and having to fight for the opportunity to do one more thing. So I think it's very well said, Katie. Thank you.
I don't know if you guys can hear me. This is Rob Silverman.
Yep, can hear you.
You can hear me. Okay. So one of the things, I guess I feel pretty strongly that in this particular type of business, when you're selling services or selling, more importantly, solutions, a couple of things. One is, people will buy your help at the exact specific time that they need it, not before, not after. So it becomes a little bit more difficult to do, you know, kind of proactive lead generation in a way that you're actually direct selling, because the time they need you to solve a certain problem will be exactly when they need you, which is all the more reinforcement to market with a broader brush and to stay in front of them continuously. So this idea of thought leadership, this idea of blogs, this idea of creating an ongoing communication that becomes a relationship, even if you're not selling directly to them, is the better way to sell, you know, to articulate all the different things that you can do for them. When you are talking to them, and I think it was, you know, I think Katie probably said it best. I mean, this idea of selling solutions can get misinterpreted. You're not trying to put everything you do into little boxes so that, you know, hopefully someone will buy one of the boxes. Because all it really does is minimize or commoditize what you do. When you get into a direct conversation, most important thing is to listen, not to talk. And when you're building solutions, it's the wrong word for it. You're really identifying problems that you solve, because that's what buyers really are looking for.
Right. And then you have an ideal situation when you can develop that into a market by having a lot of people with the same problem that have to solve it, and that drives enough value that it makes an interesting price that can drive the business around. So, well said. Thank you. Anybody else want to jump in?
Yeah, Peter and Ray, this is Peggy.
Yeah.
Hey.
The question, this all sounds fabulous and is some of what we're experiencing and having a lot of fun with, though also experience pervasive thinking that the way to grow big is to bid on bigger deals, which requires a significant investment in the BD arm of the corporation. And right, and it seems like the winning logic is to go find the big deals and bid on them, because that will win some big ones, which will, you know, allow us to grow bigger. And demand is already out there for those things. So you're sort of weighing that against the solution approach, which is more about how to create demand and influence market, which is perceived to be a slower path.
Well, but the thing is, it's also more advantage because you have the unfair advantage because you know and have something that's going to set you apart. Because in the business development mode where you're swinging for the fences on all these big deals, you're just one of the crowd. There's nothing particular necessarily that distinguishes you, unless there is, in which case you're following the other model.
Right.
So what we do see people doing exactly what you're saying, and what we encourage them to do gradually, because it's hard to break the habit of doing what you just said, but to introduce a little bit of discipline, figure out which of those big deals they can get that unfair advantage of and sort of bring the two together. Right. And then that works, and then you do more of that. Were you getting to a specific hard part of that you wanted to make sure to reveal? What was that it?
I think you've given part of it, and I think to your last point, it's a question of how to balance both. Right? So if there's a way to find demand that's already out there that can be solved with solutions that we uniquely offer, that's what you would say would be the ideal.
Right. I would look for all those big deals we want to go after and say, which ones can we have can we create an unfair advantage based on something we know, have, or learned in the past? Red, do you want to jump in there?
Well, I think maybe just to reinforce some of the comments you guys are both making, but I think it's very easy to convince yourself mathematically that big deals are better. In other words, if you don't have to keep reselling the same team over and over again, you know, every 3 months or every 6 months, it's great for profitability. It's great for a lot of things. So I think, you know, all firms probably want big deals, and they should. And it's also true, of course, that you won't win big deals if you don't bid, because, you know, the bigger the deal is, the more likely it is to be an RFP type of process where you have to bid. But at the same time, they do cost a lot of money. So you really have to be smart, I think, about thinking about for the kind of deals you're talking about, whether your firm, you know, can win. You know, what do people buy when they're buying the particular kinds of big deals that are, you know, being discussed? And is it realistic for for your firm to win those deals? And then try to come up with a model that, exactly as Peter says, you know, what are the deals that you really shouldn't lose, you know, and make sure you bid on those. And then maybe take a flyer once in a while on some other deals, but not too many of them, because, you know, each one of them costs a bunch of time and money to even make the bid.
I can ask one other. Do you have a couple of examples of places that have taken this solution approach seriously and grown as healthily as a result?
Yeah, I mean, most of the companies I've worked with eventually fall into that pattern. I mean, at American Management Systems, where we did consulting work for large banks and governments, you saw us solve a problem for like an example, Wells Fargo Bank credit card collections department, to build a system to increase the productivity and performance of collections operations. That's what we used to do in those days, design and build custom systems. And that particular system, we said, wait a minute, other banks probably need this. And we turned that into an offering that we then took to every major credit granting organization in the industry, in the country, and in the world, and then in other industries. And that ended up driving hundreds of millions of dollars in project work over 15, 20 years, and in fact, it's still going on. At CompuSearch, they were in the business of managing procurements for against the federal acquisition regulations for government agencies, but the Department of Transportation asked them to build a system to do that on an automated basis, which turned into a product called Prism that now drives, you know, $50, $60 million worth of business for CompuSearch on an annual basis and growing. We see it happen over and over and over again. And it doesn't constrain the business in any particular way. You can still do all those wonderful things they used to do. It just creates a flywheel for a part of the business that can then be scaled and then spins off other flywheels. So with that Wells Fargo example, first we built the collection system, then we built an origination system, then we built the servicing system, and you have a whole collection of flywheels, and now you've got an exciting business opportunity. We actually had a few of these as well.
Yeah, I'll give one, I guess. So when I was at Plural, which was a Microsoft specialist firm that eventually was acquired by Dell, first of all, I had the brilliant timing to go there right after the internet bubble burst. So instead of You know, it's, instead of worrying about how to build as fast as we wanted to build, we were worrying about how to survive. And I realized that a lot of what we were doing was work for some of the larger investment banks, where in effect we were doing more or less the same, you know, the same programming on a custom basis over and over. It was a primarily Microsoft programming shop. And we figured out some ways to turn our, you know, turn what we were doing into a sort of reusable toolkit in the same space. And it immediately changed everything about the way that we marketed and sold, because instead of basically saying we have smart guys that can do this, we said, you know, we have a starter kit that can get you there faster, better, cheaper, with less risk than, you know, than we think you can get there any other way. And, you know, so even in a bad market, we started winning deals. We actually managed to start growing the revenues again. And, you know, it led to some of the biggest deals the firm had ever had pretty quickly. So, you know, and it's nothing that if you, you know, saw what, you know, Peter had done at AMS, you wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't think was pretty obvious, but it's certainly more another great proof point, I think.
Anybody else want to throw out an example?
I have a question.
Okay.
Just curious about, I feel like at least I personally come up against resistance against maybe doing what is right on a semi-frequent basis. I'm just curious, Peter and Ray, have you ever had a time when you had to just walk away because the client wasn't listening to what was the right thing, or have you always been able to overcome that challenge?
Because I think, oh yeah, come leaping to mind, Ray, for you.
I've definitely had a few situations I walked away from, and usually had to do with the fact that I thought we couldn't, you know, we couldn't do a decent job of what we were being, of what the client was potentially interested in. And it's very, but I agree with you, it's very hard to do. You know, it's very difficult. It's obviously situational. You know, what you want to do in any case like that is, you know, figure out how to preserve, how, you know, how to preserve the relationship and how to try to make a virtue of it.
I think what my mind runs to is kind of doing what's right and best for the whole. So it's not a matter of selling this or doing that. It's a matter of what's going on here and what's the right and best thing to do, and getting into that frame of mind, and then realizing that any two rational behaving people in the face of the same data will make the same decision. So if that's the case, then there must be something that they know that I don't know, that I know that they don't know, that if we both knew everything each other knows, we would come to the same decision. So what am I missing? What are they missing? And I would try to attack it from there. That said, there's politics and other irrationalities that creep in, and in those cases, it's sometimes just not worth the trouble. It's not going to work. And then the other factor is that it's sometimes just not going to work. So you've got to just leave. It's something people say, the customer is always right. Well, you know, maybe not. Go ahead there.
I'm sorry. This is Rob Silverman again. So yeah. I guess when I'm in this situation, the first thing that usually comes to my mind is there's a couple of things. You know, one is, am I listening right? Okay.
Right.
So it could be they're not getting it. It could be that I'm not listening and don't really understand what their real problem is. It could be that they're not saying what their real problem is. So it could be that you don't know what the real problem is, that they're not articulating what the real problem is, that you have the wrong client, meaning there's someone else that has the problem that you know needs to be solved, but this person isn't feeling the same pain. And that could be for political reasons. That could be I tell this story all the time. I remember back in the late 90s going into the CIO of DOD and telling him, you know, about decision support systems. And the guy turned to me and said, well, we in the Navy have decision support systems. They're called staff.
Right.
If we need information, we just ask them to go get information. Right. So, yes, we can make it easier, but that wasn't the problem that he had.
Right. Heather, one other thing I would say to that is in that situation, don't handle it alone. You should do what Katie did, which is pull together everything that you see and know and understand going on, and get together a forum to present it and review it with outside people with perspective that you may, you know, not have and appreciate, and who can ask hard questions and help you think through and come up with the best possible solution, which may well be to walk away, but it may also lead to the kind of breakthrough that you need to figure out how to pop that thing. With that, we sort of probably should begin the wrap up here. I want to point out that we do have a few selected references on page 17, which we highly recommend that you take a look at. There is a post on Intellivent called Sales, Whose Problem Is It Anyway? That's a good introduction to all of this and may get you started if you're looking for something like that. And then we always recommend David Maister's book, Managing the Professional Services Firm. It really is sort of the Bible of the book on how to think about and how to run and operate professional services firms of any and all kind. Ray, I think you wanted to put this one out, right? The Rainmaking?
The Fort Harding book? Yeah. It's also a great book, and I think it really speaks to some of what Rob was alluding to a little while ago, which is the issue of, you know, there's a time in a relationship with a client when they're ready to buy something that you can deliver. But if you want to get the call at that point, you know, what do you do in the way of networking and other things to make sure that basically you find out about that opportunity, you know, when it comes along? And Fort Harding's book does the best job of anything I've ever read on the topic of how to do professional networking and other things in a really positive way, and in a way that basically feels like in a way you're having a consulting relationship with a client, even though it's not a commercial relationship, but also in a way that's low cost. You know, so I definitely recommend that for anyone, particularly who's in the sort of you know, management consulting or soft consulting kind of field, pretty much any kind of field like that.
And some of you may know Peter Block's book on flawless consulting, which helps to pull apart the different mindsets you can have as a consultant. Are you doing it for a client instead of a client, or to the client, or with the client, and trying to draw it out from within? It's important to have your mindset right and at least clear and consistent and work within that. And then there's my book called Manage to Lead, Seven Truths to Help You Change the World, which is a systematic way of coming in and understanding an organization, where it is, where it needs to be, and why, and then what you need to do to get there, and then how do you get it there. And a lot of the how do you get it there is what's rarely actually written about, but a lot of it has to do with governance and bringing the right talent and to do the right things at the right time in a systematic way. And in terms of next steps, that's our big recommendation on page 16. Most important in the context of this discussion and this insight is to do that for account reviews. In future insights, we'll probably talk about the same sort of thing for solutions and projects and other you know, units and other dimensions of the business. But today we're focusing on account reviews. We actually have a service where we'll do that, but whether you use us or not, it's just important to do them. You can look at the methodology and just start doing them for yourselves, involve other people from outside to give you a fresh perspective, tap into us to get you started if you like, or to become part of the system doing that like we do for many of our clients. It's also a good idea to tap into the body of knowledge like this. We have lots of insights, lots of tools, lots of content. You'll notice on Clue that there are insights, which is what we're covering here today, and there are services. We have listed a service for conducting this sort of work if you're interested in tapping into that. So with that, I hope you have enjoyed this session and gotten something important out of it. And we look forward to your comments and feedback afterwards. And there'll be some things coming out from Clue that will survey you. And you're welcome to write me or any of us a note at any time to continue the discussion, ask follow-on questions, or otherwise engage with us, and we'll look forward to doing that with you.